Thank you, Doug.
Guy.com.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View here on BBSRadio.com for Monday, December 13th. Once again, I'm your host, PK, and I'll be with you for the next hour. And you can contact me at my email address, which is pkbbs2@gmail.com. As always, I'd like to thank my friend Don Nikoloff for helping me to produce my show and for his advice. And at this time, he's trying to stay warm and shovel snow and balance a lot of family stuff. So I appreciate his availability during all this busy stuff. And, of course, you know, Santa's on the way. In fact, he'll be here next weekend, I believe. So I'm sure everybody's looking forward to that. Although it might be a blue Christmas for a lot of people with this economy. Are you there, Don? How's it going?
Well, I'm here. It's going. Let's put it that way.
It's going, yeah. It's been frantic, yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm good. As I mentioned last week, I'm in recovery still from my emergency detached retina surgery, and my eye is getting better. It's less swollen. And so another few weeks, I hope it's pretty much back to normal. However, I will need to wear a contact over that eye, where that is the same eye that I had cataract surgery done last March. And then I had great distance vision, and then I had good mono vision because I had a contact in my right eye so I could see far and see close. But now I'm going to lose some distance, so I'm going to need to wear a contact on the left eye, too, which I'm not complaining about. I'm just glad, you know, hopefully it'll all work. So, again, thank goodness for this technology in these times we live in. Of course, soon everything is going to be free in healthcare, you know, Obamacare. So I'm sure the quality of medicine will go up and everything else.
Well, yeah. People have been
it's going to bring costs down, just like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. People say, oh, those are great programs. Yeah, well, they're dripping in red ink, and there's a reckoning day coming.
Well, we've been praying for your rapid recovery, and with the good news that you're going to have your sight and it's going to be working, you'll be able to see the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, as they continue to hide it. Recently it came out, like, it's over 800,000 Americans are involved in security or, you know, national security, or they have all these security clearances. So basically you have maybe one half of the federal government trying to hide and obscure the truth. That's their daily job to, you know, obscure the truth, tell half lies, and distort history. And yes, we have certain freedoms. We have the right to vote, but that voting is certainly shrouded in secrecy and things behind the scenes that, yeah, people can vote, but and what they think they see or know ain't what they really think or see they know, because as I've learned in the last few years, so many things are staged, mainly by the federal government, and it's you know, it's court jesters. They're court historians. They're court apologists for whichever regime is in power. And as we know, the foreign policy stays the same. So what I've really learned in the last few years is that most of these wars we've been involved in were staged on our behalf, or they exploit current events to involve Americans or the American military in overseas wars or things that really don't concern us, or things that, like FDR, provoked Japan and all these sort of things. So now they say our troops are fighting for our freedoms. Well, I appreciate their service and their bravery, but I don't see them fighting for our freedoms. I see them fighting to support and maintain a global empire, which is collapsing at the same time. So that is something that's going to just probably collapse on its own, sort of like the Roman Empire. It can't be sustained, and there's a lot of inflation coming in the wings, and prices don't all rise uniformly. You'll start seeing higher prices here and there, but you know, the cumulative effect will be maybe a couple years down the road, but it's out there, regardless of Bernanke's lies and half-truths. That is something to be concerned about, this you know, potential inflation. In fact, earlier this week or last week, the Federal Reserve had the gall to tell a bank branch in Oklahoma that it could not display Christmas symbols. And that provoked a lot of outcry. Then they got a call from the Fed, I guess, last Friday, and they relented. I mean, I'd have told them to go to hell. I mean, who are they to tell? You know, it's bad enough they're creating money out of thin air. Now they're telling you how you have to decorate your bank.
Well, I suppose if you hung Nazi swastikas on a Christmas tree, that would be acceptable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
And speaking of the swastika, it's interesting how that the swastika is always held as evil, but the sickle and the hammer, you could wear that or get by with the sickle and the hammer, which when you just look at the death rate, the sickle and the hammer is responsible for probably 10 times the death of the swastika. Not that, you know, the swastika is any good thing, but it seems like the you know, it isn't allowed, yet the sickle and the hammer, you can get away with that. You can have it on a Che Guevara T-shirt or whatever. You know, the truth is that the sickle and the hammer has caused a lot more death. But there you have it. So,
well, the swastika is the reverse of what is known as the Wheel of Fortune in metaphysics.
Well, doesn't the swastika come from ancient Hindi Sanskrit?
No, the Wheel of Fortune does, and they reversed it. They made it turn in the opposite direction.
And they turned it on its side, too. I mean, the one I've seen in old stuff, it's like parallel, but the Nazis turned it at an angle.
Well, it doesn't matter how they position it. The idea is that it's supposed to turn in a circle, and they made it counterclockwise juxtaposition. In other words, it resembles spinning to the left as opposed to spinning to the right. They reversed everything because the Wheel of Fortune is a metaphysical symbol for abundance and prosperity for all, and they reversed it. So it was their own little design for them, for their rituals. That's all.
Well, you know, that's something I want to get into in the future about World War II and Nazi Germany and the whole deal, because there's a lot coming out now, especially, there was a lot of collusion with powerful Zionists between the Nazis and the Zionists about the transfer agreement, transferring Jews to Palestine, and in fact, the Germans offered a lot of the Hungarian Jews to the Allies for a couple million dollars just for the transferring them and all this and that, and they refused. So interesting things are coming out now, and I like the saying that time is the greatest friend of truth. So, you know, a lot of this doesn't come out till later, till it sifts through more history and more historians start checking things and filling in where the status quo court historians have conveniently left things out. Or, you know, either deliberately or just unknowingly, but that's the job of revisionism, to put in the, you know, fill in a lot of the missing links. So this is something I do want to get into in the future. And
okay. Well, I'm here if you need me. I'm going to step back and allow
okay,
you
thanks.
To
Now, last week, I think I sort of, I was talking about, actually the last 2 weeks, I've been talking about my interest in Austrian economics and the ethics of liberty. So I put together my own secession solution, or a new constitution, if you will, modeled on the current one a bit, only it takes a lot more teeth in tying down government power to a very strict, limited constitutional government, very strictly limited to probably about 95% of what it does today, because I would remind everybody that the states created the federal government, not the other way around. And since all that time, the federal government has seized amazing amount of power and control, way beyond what the framers intended. And I contend that only nullification and secession will solve this problem of a huge, unchecked federal government that cannot be reformed, contrary to all beliefs. I don't believe it can be reformed. It's just a huge welfare warfare state. You know, it continues to bankrupt our nation, and it's hungry for taxes and power and control. And it not only creates havoc here at home, but it does abroad, too. And in that federal government is the Federal Reserve System, which caused this this meltdown, which caused the economic mess we're in right now, because it created a credit expansion by lowering interest rates. I was bickering with a banker friend last week. You know, he doesn't understand this. Despite his master's in finance, his reason was it's greedy, lazy Americans caused this problem. Well, I said to him, really? Well, did greedy, lazy Americans lower the interest rate to near zero, keep it low like that, and create the illusion of cheap, very inexpensive money, cheap to borrow? You know, did they cause this mess? You know, and he really didn't have an answer for that. So that is the crux of a lot of Austrian economics understands that money does not play a neutral role. It plays a very important role in the economy. And when you have a out-of-control central bank that's just creating money out of thin air and arrogant towards the gold standard or sound money, that's what you're faced with like we have now, and I see it as only getting worse. I am very glad that Ron Paul is the head of one of these monetary committees where he'll have some serious oversight on the Fed, so I hope there's some fireworks down the road for this, and I don't know how much subpoena power he'll have or how much power he'll have to investigate, but I'm sure that he's going to cause them some grief, and Bernanke's not happy about what's going on. But Ron Paul, who is very well rehearsed in economics, the ethics of liberty, social philosophy, to me, and I'm not just raving about him because I'm a Ron Paul fanatic, he has the education, he has the know-how to fix these things. It's like there's a, I hate to use the word messiah, but there's a person in our own midst. It's like we have a modern-day Thomas Jefferson right here pointing the way in a very humble way. And most people aren't really grasping it, but he's being proven more right all the time. And Ron Paul doesn't have a crystal ball, nor do I, but when you understand Austrian economics and what's in store for us by artificial credit expansion by a central bank, which lowers the interest rate and causes people to borrow money, I think they think it's cheap, and borrow on their homes, and you know, I think the price of their homes is always going up. And now we're faced with this catastrophe of today. And what is their solution? It's giving the heroin addict more heroin, creating more money out of thin air, although Bernanke claims he didn't do that, but he's even contradicted himself in his own lies about creating money. I guess they create some of it digitally, but, you know, there's a reckoning day for creating so much paper money out of thin air. And it's maybe a year or two down the line, so be prepared, folks. I spoke about the monetary system. I spoke about taxation. I don't think I got into Social Security. I don't know if I forgot where I left off. No, I was past there. I actually got into health care. I'm going to talk about charity and social welfare. I'm going to start there again. Private charity is the foundation of what a free society has, because people should help other people because they feel it is the right thing to do. And one doesn't need religion or spiritual to know that. One doesn't have to be religious or spiritual to know that it's a good thing to help people in need. All different people of all different stripes, creeds, races, etc., etc. So private charity is necessary and very much encouraged in the society that I see, which is free of a huge central government which is calling the shots on everything. Because let's face it, all crime is local. All poverty is local. All pollution is local. So, back to charity and social welfare. The way I see my society, there is no government interference or harassment of private charity. So soup kitchens, feeding the homeless and the less fortunate, and caring for the sick are the duties of numerous charities and voluntary doctor care. And this would include help from churches, food banks, Goodwill, the Red Cross, Salvation Army, rescue missions, and, of course, numerous secular and religious charities. And that could include Christian, Muslim, Jewish charities, Hindu charities, Buddhist charities, agnostic charities, atheist charities, and any other private charity should welcome help and give that help to those in need. And, of course, there will be less needy people in the economic system I lay out, because there will be less unemployment. There won't be all this war preparation and all this intervening in other countries, and there especially will not be a drug war, which has really harmed low-income people and the poor. So just getting rid of that alone will make a big difference in raising people's standard of living and getting rid of a lot of hopelessness and despair. Now, as far as all current public housing, that is government-owned housing, I suggest deeding it over to the current tenants, so it would be then it would become theirs to own and maintain and or to sell if they want. And there was no more government-forced urban renewal, which in the past it uprooted whole neighborhoods. For example, in the black community, uprooted whole infrastructures of the black community, black-owned businesses, black-owned homes, and whole infrastructures and neighborhoods. And they then sometimes created less housing than they tore down. And then they stacked all these people in, tall government high-rises, which became rife with crime and all sorts of things. So that's what urban renewal, it's, good intentions, and then you have this mess. So, again, with an economic system I'm advocating, my secession solution, we'd have an economic system with micro-taxes, micro-regulations, and no drug war, which will greatly lessen the number of poor and lower-income people while providing more opportunity in that sea of hopelessness and despair that's out there. So that is something that would be a step in the right direction, where we would decentralize all this stuff, and we'll take care of people locally and encourage, work instead of welfare and, even these charities can teach people meaningful occupations or help them get their feet on the ground. So, moving on now to guns. Well, folks, only free men own guns. I know the liberals wet their pants about guns, but too bad the ACLU doesn't care to. They don't seem to protect property rights as much as they do like civil liberties, like of course free speech and religious freedom, freedom of assembly, of course. I support those, too. The ACLU, they fall short, for example, on guns. They don't, I wouldn't think they really support the full Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The way I see the gun situation or gun ownership in the society with the secession solution Constitution that I advocate, there would be basically no gun control, no gun confiscation. Now, like credit checks, background checks and police reports would detect undesirable would-be purchasers. There would be very few gun ownership restrictions except towards violent criminals or violent ex-felons. So the use of firearms for other than sport, hunting, or self-defense would be subject to harsh prosecution and incarceration. However, once again, because there is no drug prohibition and no drug war, there'd be vastly increased employment opportunities, and the incidence of violent gun crimes and murder will decrease, as will crime in general. So this drug war cannot be separated from the gun issue. In fact, last year I was at a 4th of July rally, and there was a booth, many booths, and there was one for the NRA. And I proudly walked up to them and said that I'm a very proud gun owner, but I will never join the NRA as long as it supports the drug war. And they hemmed or hawed with me, but I said, sorry, there's no way I'm going to join, because it's tough enough to protect, to defend gun rights now. And the drug war makes it even worse. And the fact that you all still support the drug war, you're sort of complicit in making gun ownership more difficult and putting us more on the offensive. And they reluctantly, you know, heard what I had to say, and some of them reluctantly agreed with me. But to this day, I'm a proud gun owner, but I will never join the NRA as long as it supports the drug war. So that is my view on guns. I'm not really worried about people if they have so-called assault weapons, because in a society where other people own assault weapons, you kind of equalize things down. And as far as the NRA, let me say something on their behalf. NRA members, and for the most part, I know, 99.9% of NRA members are not robbing stores. They're not robbing banks. They're not doing home invasions. They're not doing carjackings. They're the ones that are going to shoot people who do that to them, or try to invade their house or their property, or hurt, try to carjack them. The NRA people, they're the ones that will kill violent criminals who seek to do these sort of things. So I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of open carry. If I see open carry people around me, I own guns. I don't have any handguns, but I'm not frightened, because they're going to take down any criminal who uses a gun, you know, illegally. So I'm not worried about people who carry firearms or have concealed, Of course, I don't like violent criminals who have concealed weapons, but chances are they're going to face people who aren't criminals with concealed firearms, and they're going to have to, you know, deal with that accordingly. So, I'm very pro-gun, very pro-gun ownership, and people need to keep this in mind when I speak about foreign policy, because I'm against these wars, and I'm against stationing troops overseas and intervening in other countries' business, while at the same time, I'm very pro-gun rights. Now, a lot of the typical anti-war crowd, you know, a lot of them are anti-gun, too. But that's an inconsistency that I do not have. So, anyway, moving on from guns, I'm going to talk now about energy. And, of course, I still I support a free market in energy with a multi-pronged approach, which would include oil, natural gas, coal, nuclear, wind, and other developing technologies. However, I'm totally opposed to any government subsidies to energy producers, which only results in political privilege, more corporate welfare, crony capitalism, and more government industry partnership boondoggles, like that tragic ethanol situation, which it's very inefficient. It's burning useful corn, using corn crops, which would be better used for other purposes, including livestock feed or foodstuffs. And also, I guess it's very water intensive. And now they want to raise the ethanol level that they could add to gasoline. Well, as I understand it, this is very bad for older vehicles. So, you know, what another way to hurt people, lower income people, or people with cars that aren't new? Damaging their cars from a higher ethanol content, forcing them into getting newer cars, when the last thing they need to do is spend more, which is part of the problem with the whole country, is this addiction to credit and spending. I mean, over the last, more than the last 10 years or so, I kept getting almost every week, I'm approved for, you know, 5,000 here, 10,000 there, 20,000 there. I tore that stuff up and threw it away. I saw, it's like the drug of cheap credit. Here it is. and then people get into that, and then they can't pay their bills, and they, you know, they've taken that, they've taken the bait. Anyway, back to energy. So again, I say there should be no government subsidies to energy producers, and no government imposed damage liability caps, like they did with BP. I believe it was $20 billion, and then they had to deal with the federal government on that. I would have said the hell with that. BP should have dealt with the state of Louisiana and Mississippi, and you know those people that live in those states. Let them deal with BP. Once again, not that rapacious, expensive middleman, which is Washington, D.C. So I would not have gone that route with BP. Also, no government persecution or harassment of alternative energy producers or inventors. Well, again, I want a free market in this. However, as I understand it right now, and I was at a libertarian convention several years ago, when I heard a speaker talk about, he was from an institute, I think it was the, I can't recall, I think it was the Fraser Institute. I might be wrong. But what I understood from his lecture was, and he was for alternative technologies too, alternative energy in a free market sense. But what I got out of his lecture was that pretty much fossil fuels still win hands down at this point in time. And I'm not excluding any alternatives again. I just don't want government involved in it, because then they, you know, they get their tentacles in there. With that comes more control. Yeah, you might get subsidies and become politically privileged, but you're still subject to more government control and red tape and all this junk. And that's something I don't want to see more of. As far as ethanol, for example, Brazil burns sugarcane, which apparently is more efficient to burn than corn, and it's a better biofuel, I guess, if you will. But of course, we have protectionist laws that keep out less expensive sugar and sugarcane, because we have a sort of a powerful sugar lobby, especially I think it's in the southern part of the state of Florida, where they're producing sugar inefficiently, and a lot of the runoff goes into the Everglades. So, you know, people might blame capitalism, but it's more like it's statism. It's state capitalism or corporate socialism that gives these domestic sugar producers the ability to use the state, and when I say the state, I usually mean the federal government, the state to exclude less expensive foreign sugar. So, again, in my type of economy, that wouldn't be the case either, because they wouldn't have this protectionism. If they could produce sugar efficiently and make a profit on it without government support, that's okay. Otherwise, industries do not need their continuous training wheels from the federal government to just be on the federal tit forever, bilking taxpayers, and then still charging for their products. So it's something that needs to be corrected. And once again, the free market approach will solve this problem. Now, while I'm at energy, I am sort of a disciple of the late, great Dr. Thomas Gold. I contend that his reasoning is correct when he said that oil is not a fossil fuel. In a nutshell, oil is an abiotic fuel. It is constantly being produced by the Earth's mantle. And if they drill deep enough, they'll usually find it. And Russia, as I understand it, is the leading technology for deep oil drilling. You might have to go down 30, 40 miles at times, but generally it's there. So I would think that there's plenty of oil and natural gas and coal in the planet to last a very long time, or at least till alternatives are developed. And I believe those alternatives should be worked upon now, through the free market and through individual or people investing and innovating, and through entrepreneurship. That's the direction I see it going in. So that is not a problem if the government will just get out of the way and stop protecting the established interests. That's where the lobby situation is, lobbies and all this sort of thing. So if we had a true free market in energy, we would not have a lot of these problems we're having right now. So that is how I see it. It's a shame that when you see these in oil fields, when you see that all those that fire at the top of those stacks. Apparently, they're burning off all the natural gas that they have nowhere to contain or put it. It's a shame to waste all that. I just wonder how much they burn off every day that could be used for, you know, heating or, you know, running different countries. It's just too bad they have to burn it all off. But it's apparently natural gas is cleaner and more efficient, and there's a lot of it. So, again, a multi-pronged approach is what I advocate. And it includes, and one other thing I need to mention again, as I have before, is that there will also be no hemp prohibition. So that adds to the energy sources also, as far as alternative, the hemp product for fiber, hemp fiber for building, for clothing, possibly food, for rope, for paper, many things. Okay. So I've touched on energy, a lot of the main things that I see. Now, I'm going next to foreign policy and defense. And this is the issue that really usually separates Ron Paul Republicans or Jeffersonian constitutional Republicans from neoconservatives and the interventionist crowd. Because foreign policy and defense, the way it is now, regardless of who's in power, whichever party, whichever one government party with two heads or the one bird of prey with two wings, whenever they're in power, the foreign policy pretty much stays the same. On the surface, they talk about a few things, they tweak a few things here and there, but it pretty much stays the same, intervening in civil wars across the world at the behest of the endlessly huge, growing, way beyond constitutional bounds, military-industrial-congressional complex. And that huge defense budget is sucking away valuable capital from other goods that need to be produced, consumer goods, non-defense spending. So in a nutshell, my view on foreign policy and defense is this, and I'm echoing the views of the founders in my first sentence here, is that armed neutrality and free trade with goodwill to all nations are the foundations of our foreign policy. Armed neutrality and free trade. And that doesn't mean that a central government is going around the world or linking up with other governments and they're staging false flag attacks or they're trying to lure us or, you know, engineer us into wars to get, you know, all the, you know, that cowboy mentality up everybody's backside up about going to war. We got to go to war here or there. They don't look at the long-range consequences, even the short-range consequences. So in my world, there are no false flag operations being thrown in our faces and where we're expected to rally around the flag when it's, again, the central government is staging these things to expand the military-industrial complex and to expand empire, which is so hypocritical today, especially when the country's broke. So, and with my foreign policy and defense, since there will be no endlessly growing centralized welfare warfare state, as in a Washington, D.C., there will be no empire or nation building and no tax-funded foreign aid. What does tax-funded foreign aid do? It props up foreign dictators. It props up inefficient industries. The money trickles down to the people it's usually supposed to help. They get very little of that. So it's a very inefficient way to help other countries or make them more self-reliant, plus the fact that they're looting the American taxpayer without their consent. I mean, it's like a gun is aimed at our wallet, and we have to give this unconstitutional, repeat, it's unconstitutional foreign aid. If, you know, John Doe wants to write a check to help Somalia or other countries or domestic charities, we're all for that. We're all for individuals and businesses helping, you know, if they want to help other people or countries, they're free to write a check. They're free to send over tractors or seed or whatever, but not at the expense of the taxpayer. Now, all the states that are seceding or and becoming new republics or new states all seceding states would maintain a common defense, with each seceding state's National Guard and Air National Guard becomes its own defense force, and all Coast Guard ships stationed at coastal seceding states become that state's Coast Guard. And there's no need to bicker with other states. If other states haven't seceded, we still trade with other states. We're friendly with other states. People are free to come and go. Trade is very important, and Americans are free to come and go in the states that seceded. They're free to come and go to live there, work there, but there'll be different laws and fewer laws, and they'll be able to keep more of their wealth. So, again, that's an important thing in the way I see it, that the states that do secede will not shut the borders to Americans from other states, and including foreigners from other states. They're still welcome to live there, work there, and this and that. But each state's National Guard will become its own defense. And plus, you know, the citizens have strictly enforced gun rights. Right to own guns will not be interfered with, and we're not going to be nibbling around the edge of these stupid laws either. If you have a concealed weapon, or they find a weapon in your car because you're pulled over for something, they can't take your guns or confiscate your guns if you haven't been convicted of any crime. So the hammer will be put down to protect gun rights. That's for damn sure. Now back to foreign policy and defense. There would be no political or military intervention into the affairs of foreign countries, meaning there's no more U.S. military bases, over 700 military bases in over 130 foreign countries. I mean, I don't care if there's a few Marines stationed at embassies, American embassies throughout the world, you know, but the embassies should be small. They should be just promoting trade and goodwill with the country that they're in, not pushing for military bases there, not pushing to put American missiles in these other countries. Also there would be no stationing troops throughout the world. So newly seceded states, one of the last things they ever want to do is put troops somewhere else throughout the world. Ain't going to happen. It's too expensive, it's unnecessary, and it's the reason...
Hello, Doug. Have we lost contact with Fred here? With PK? Hello, Doug? Okay. Folks, hang on. We're going to get PK back on the line here. We seem to be having some communication problems. And he'll be right back with us. So hang in there.
Sorry, folks, got a few gremlins in the line there, got disconnected, but the message is still connected. I'm still talking about foreign policy and defense. Once again, there'll be no stationing of troops throughout the world, no draft registration, and no conscription, so that a government that can't draft people or make them register for the draft or conscript them cannot force them into foreign wars. And I have no doubt that Americans, or let's say not even Americans, people of any country, if they're unjustly invaded by any foreign entity, they're going to put up a fight, just like we would. And I'm, you know, all for defense. I'm not totally anti-war per se, but I'm really against staging of false flag attacks or maneuvering other countries to attack because we've cut off their oil or trade with them, these underhanded things, and then expecting good people to, you know, brandish a gun and go fight on behalf of the central state. No thanks. No thank you. That ain't going to happen. So that's my foreign policy thing, which is centered around armed neutrality and free trade. So, yes, we're a powerful nation. We can defend our borders and take care of ourselves. Well, at the same time, we're not going to instigate trouble overseas. So with a revamped foreign policy, this would certainly put those principles into effect. And again, nobody's gun rights are threatened. In fact, they're strengthened. Now, moving on to NASA. NASA, not another socialist administration. Okay, NASA facilities would not be disturbed, but no longer funded by seceding states. There is no tax-funded space program. And at the same time, there's no government interference with private sector space exploration. So if private entrepreneurs want to send a rocket ship out or space or land on the moon or charge people $1 million to go on a flight in outer space, they're free to do that. They're free to create. They're free to produce. Personally, the way NASA is right now, I would put it on the auction block and I would sell it to all investors, domestic and foreign. And I would have the Air Force handle the strategic part of it. But otherwise, it's not in the Constitution, and a lot of it just fulfills the dreams of scientists who want to go here and there. I mean, I'm all for research, but I don't think I don't want to see the taxpayers funding this. You know, John Q. Public's just trying to make a living and feed his family. He doesn't need to be taxed and forced to pay corporate welfare into NASA, which is more corporate welfare. It's a corporate socialism, it's state capitalism, it's not real capitalism. So that is how I would deal with NASA. Whatever the facilities are, be they in the South or wherever they are, if that state were to secede, business as usual there, they can come and go, but we're not going to pay for it. So, but at the same time, we're not going to tear their buildings down and kick them out. They can have their stuff there, maybe it could be sold off and more efficiently. So that's to meet the test of the market. And again, the market is a constant discovery process. It's not a thing or a person. It's a constant discovery process. So that is how things are determined through the daily biddings of entrepreneurs, buyers, sellers, investors, creators, producers. All these people interact, which seems like anarchy on the surface, but underneath that is a very sort of well-organized market system that works throughout the world. We don't need globalism to have free trade. I'm very anti-globalism as it is, if you're talking World Trade Organization, NAFTA, UN, World Bank, all these globalist entities. We don't need all that crap. All we need is free trade. And you don't need protectionism to have free trade. We don't need all these other things. This is what the globalists want. It's not what I want, and it's not my take on real free enterprise. So, as I've mentioned these things before, I think I was speaking about economics. That is something that we want to reshape, too. I advocate getting out of all these globalist entities and just embarking on free trade without NAFTA and, CAFTA and all these globalist things that just prop up the status quo. It's not real free enterprise. It's not real capitalism. I'd like to be the great reformer and bring on what really is the, honest capitalism, free enterprise. We're pro-free enterprise versus being pro-business per se. We're not pro-business per se. We're pro-free enterprise. There's a difference, meaning that businesses come and go in the marketplace, and if they don't succeed, they don't get bailed out. They can go to the banks, they can go to their creditors, they can sell shares, stock, but they can't get bailed out because in an honest world of free enterprise, there are no bailouts and there is no bank or business that's too big to fail. And if they fail, they reorganize, and they should reorganize in an atmosphere of what should be micro-taxes and micro-regulations. And, of course, bankruptcy plays an important role, too, because it helps liquidate bad investments and bring on a new seed money or seed capital to restart the business that went under or something new in its place. And that should just continue because failure is an important part of learning too. Okay, I'm jumping around a lot, but it's something I like to do. So stay with me. Okay, here's another great federal program, Amtrak. What an efficient train system that is. Now, the way I see Amtrak is through the newly seceded states or republics or territories, Amtrak trains may run undisturbed to our newly seceded states or republics or territories. We will pay to ride Amtrak trains, but we will send no taxes to Washington to subsidize Amtrak. So we won't disturb their tracks or their railroad stations. We will ride Amtrak. We'll pay to ride, but none of our taxes get sent to subsidize it. Okay, that is my view on Amtrak. Now, to the environment. Something I learned from Ayn Rand is that pollution is essentially a scientific problem. So I built on that. It's essentially a scientific problem requiring numerous diverse technologies, innovations, inventions, ideas, and improvements of existing technologies. This is the way we will solve the pollution problem. Yes, people have to be responsible in their own lives, and businesses have to be responsible, but these are the details that I've come up with to make it more efficient, cleaner, and better all around. I believe in strict liability applied to producers through tort law and property rights. For example, the government couldn't say to BP, okay, well, you're only liable for $5 billion. We cap it at that. Well, what if it's more than that? What if it's a lot more than that? What are the people, you know, the people who are hurt, what are they supposed to do? Because a lot of people who are hurt, let's face it, they're capitalists too. If you have a shrimp in business or a restaurant or a hotel, those are capitalists too, and they don't need to be harmed by the bigger capitalists, if you will, the oil companies or the other crowd. So they have property rights, and it would be addressed through tort law and mainly tort law and their own property rights. There is no government protection of special interest group polluters. No protection through the EPA. They are subject to being tried in court for pollution trespass. So special interest groups don't get any special privilege either. There's no government-enforced limits on polluters' liability. And this is very important, too. There is no harassment or persecution of alternative pollution technology and environmental protection technology. So those businessmen or entrepreneurs who seek to come up with their ideas or their view of alternative pollution technology, they will not be disturbed, they will not be harmed, they will be allowed to flourish, and hopefully they will profit handsomely off of helping protect the environment without mandatory everybody going green, which is part of what I believe is sort of the environmentalists' religion. I believe that the global warming crowd is just as wrong about global warming as the pro-war crowd is about war. I believe that on one side of the coin you have the radical environmentalists who are screaming the sky is falling, and on the other side you have the crowds saying the end is near because the Lord is coming, the end is near. So, I mean, I reject both sides of that coin. But I especially see the self-righteousness of the left who to me, they're... global warming crowd, it's become like a religion to them, and if you contest it, you're an evil skeptic. Well, I guess I'm an evil skeptic. I don't doubt that man had a little to play with global climate change per se, but probably nothing to the extent of which they're telling us it is. Now I want to speak about briefly eminent domain.
Well,
I see very narrowly defined conditions of eminent domain,
that,
which apply mainly to roads and bridges, power lines, utilities, and railroad tracks. Private property may never be taken from its rightful owners and given unethically to other private owners and or private developers, regardless of compensation. And this crap has happened. Imagine that city's condemning some building so they can give it to another developer. I mean, that's not... There was no reason to do that. That's not about a school or a bridge for a waterway or a utility. It's just outright theft and stealing from rightful owners to take their property. So what? So the city can get more money because it gave it to a developer who's going to put in condos? This is very wrong, and it's an insult to private property and capitalism. It's one thing for... like I said, bridges, power lines, utilities, railroad tracks. and highways. But this other deal, which is going on, is just it's sickening. And then these people, some of who are not very well off, have to, you know, what, hire attorneys so they can fight the city and huge developers. It's wrong, and it's a slap in the face of property rights. How am I doing on time there, Don?
Well, PK, I'm trying to give you the signal there with a little bit of music. We're out of time.
Okay. Okay, everyone. Well, thanks again for listening in here at Third Stream View here on bbsradio.com. On Monday nights, you can hear us 9 o'clock Pacific, 12 midnight Eastern, 11 p.m. Central. I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in. Next week, I'll try to conclude my secession solution, and then we'll move on to some other topics in the future, and there's going to get more testy in the future, I'm sure, as I'm trying to find my stride here as your host and bring these issues forward. So thanks again for listening, and I look forward to next Monday night, same time, same place. Thanks again, Don. Thanks again, bbsradio.com. PK signing out.